Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, January 15th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, despite state law, Humboldt opting for voluntary addiction treatment. Caltrans District 1 weekly radio PSAs for January 16th through January 22nd. And for national news, Lauren Schmidt talks to Congressman Jared Huffman about what could come next in Central America, Greenland, and here at home. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
A new state law allows involuntary treatment for substance use disorder, but Humboldt County is choosing a different approach. Daniel Mintz reports.
In an update on homelessness to the Humboldt County Board of Supervisors, a new state law that expands the categories of involuntary mental health holds to include severe substance use disorder was described as largely undoable, and the county is coaxing voluntary holds instead. Housing and homelessness funding and services were discussed during a January 13th presentation to supervisors. County Behavioral Health Deputy Director Paul Bugnacki said involuntary holds aren't practical because, quote, the state does not have the infrastructure to support those types of holds. He said an alternative approach is more realistic.
The substance use disorder community, including Crossroads, Waterfront, HRC, and others, really developed a pathway to treatment locally, but not for those that are on legal holds. There are no facilities in California where somebody detained on a legal hold can go and get mandated treatment, nor is it empirically supported in the data around the efficacy of mandated SUD treatment. So our approach really is to focus in on the individual and developing a relationship with those individuals to help them to get to a place where they are voluntarily willing to go into treatment. And we've created pathways for that treatment here locally.
The new state law, SB 43, has been in effect since January 1st, and Bugnacki said Humboldt has only done one involuntary hold for substance use disorder. The county's preferred course of action is its recently formed Community Assistance, Recovery, and Empowerment Court, known as the CARE Court. In response to doubts from Supervisor Rex Bone about the effectiveness of voluntary treatment, Bugnacki explained CARE Court's value in treating challenging cases.
This is really what CARE Court is set up for. So people can petition to have somebody go into, it's not a criminal court, it's civil court, and we've spent the better part of a year leading up to CARE Court in preparation for implementation with our court system and our other interested parties and affected programs. And I think that has been utilized for individuals like that you're speaking to. So we have a website on our behavioral health website, county website, as well as the Superior Court has a website up with instructional videos and helpful links about how to petition to have somebody engage in CARE Court. Our county has stood out, as Connie had mentioned, above other counties based on the numbers of petitions that we've put forward. The community's put forward, and they're really interested in what we're doing and how we're doing it.
County Department of Health and Human Services staff members also highlighted projects on the horizon, like the Crisis Triage Center, planned to open in Arcata sometime in 2027, and expansion of the Mobile Intervention Services Team, known as MIST. Supervisors discussed the seemingly intractable challenges of addressing homelessness, with Bone saying, quote, we're never going to fix it. All we can do is make it better. County Housing Assistance Coordinator Robert Ward said housing costs are making it difficult for people to achieve permanent housing as, quote, you have to earn a lot of money to pay the rent around here. Board Chair Mike Wilson related the dilemma to a larger societal context.
A huge factor in this is just our national issue around wealth inequality. I just have to really say it very clearly. I mean, and it also, one of the things that wealth inequality drives is the consolidation of housing as assets, as which basically is causing a lot of housing to go basically vacant in many, many places. And so while we have an issue around the development of new housing, we also just have higher vacancy rates than we've had. And that includes even just less people living in housing, and as was sort of mentioned. And so that the pressure of the cost of housing is a huge factor in this. And we can call it, we can talk about mental health issues and we can talk about those other issues, but getting people into housing that exists today is becoming more difficult. And I also want to reference the federal administration's move away from supportive housing is, I think, going to be hugely negatively impactful.
On housing and homelessness related funding, Ward said the county has $1.2 million in federal funding for the year beginning in late October 2025, and $500 million in state funding is promised but not yet approved. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
And now, traffic information from Caltrans District 1.
This is a Caltrans District 1 road information bulletin for Humboldt County state highways for the week beginning Friday, January 16th. On 36, expect up to 15-minute delays near Carlotta and west of Grizzly Creek Redwood State Park. Expect delays west of Maple Grove and from the Little Irby Creek Bridge to the Butte Creek Bridge. On 96, expect delays north of Willow Creek and north of Hoopaw. On 101, construction work continues north of Herrick Avenue in Eureka. Motorists should expect minor slowdowns. Expect delays north of Warwick. On 169, expect delays at Martin's Ferry. On 254, expect delays north of Wyatt. On 255, expect up to 10-minute delays at the Samoa Bridge. On 283, expect delays at the Eagle Prairie Bridge in Rio Dell. On 299, expect up to 10-minute delays east of Chisholm Road. For Lake of Mendocino County, state highways for the week beginning Friday, January 16th. On 29, expect delays in Middletown at the St. Helena Bridge on the 16th. On 175, expect delays in Lakeport from Junction Route 29 to south of Ryan Road on the 20th. And in Mendocino County, on 1, expect delays in Albion at Spring Grove Road on the 23rd. Expect delays in Fort Bragg from Hare Creek Road to Pudding Creek Road. Expect up to 30-minute delays south of Westport at the Blues Beach Trailhead to the Overlook. Expect delays at the Wages Creek Bridge. On 20, expect delays in Willits near Monica Lane on the 20th. On 101, expect delays in Hoplin at Junction Route 175 starting on the 20th. Expect up to 15-minute delays north of Laytonville. Expect delays south of Leggett. On 128, expect delays east of Pomo Tierra Ranch Road. For Delmar County State Highways for the week beginning Friday, January 16th. On 101, expect delays from Klamath Beach Road to the Humboldt County line and north of Klamath. Expect up to 10-minute delays at the Dr. Fine Bridge and near the Rowdy Creek Bridge on the 20th. Expect up to 10-minute delays from Chrissy Road to the Oregon State line starting on the 20th. On 197, expect delays near Ruby Van Deventer County Park. For further updates, join us on social media via Caltrans District 1.
In state news, pro-democracy groups question plans to build a new California city. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
A new city proposed in Solano County, backed by tech billionaires, is drawing concern from pro-democracy groups that track right-wing philanthropy. The proposed town, 40 miles north of San Francisco, would be called California Forever. Backers promise jobs and affordable housing, but local groups like Solano Together are organizing against the idea of a for-profit charter city that would be run by an appointed executive instead of an elected mayor and city council. Jeremy Mack is executive director of the Phoenix Project, a nonprofit that follows donations in the Bay Area.
Philanthropic efforts are being used to subvert democracy. In the United States, billionaires are able to use their personal wealth foundations to channel into these different efforts that are ultimately in support of the destruction of democratic safeguards.
Research from the nonprofit National Committee on Responsive Philanthropy found that from 2020 to 2023, donors gave more than $1.5 billion to attack representative democracy and try to reverse progress on racial, gender, and economic justice in the U.S. On the campaign trail, President Donald Trump promised to build 10 so-called freedom cities on federal land with special economic zones and fewer regulations. Possible sites suggested in California include land in Alameda and at the Presidio in San Francisco. The California Forever website says its city of the future would be highly efficient and foster innovation. Max says so-called network or freedom cities could chip away at people's rights.
There's been this sort of infatuation with technocracy, moving away from representative democracy and towards elected officials, more top-down control, and a lot less citizens' oversight or say over what happens in their own communities.
A similar city is rising in Honduras called Prospera. It's envisioned as a place entirely run on cryptocurrency, with pro-business tax laws, few regulations on things like medical research, and privatized public services like schools and police. Elon Musk has built a similar city in Texas called Starbase that critics say operates like a company town of old, where everything ties back to the biggest employer around. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, despite initially receiving enough Republican support to advance the Venezuelan War Powers Resolution, enough so to bring it to a floor vote, the legislation ultimately failed Wednesday after two GOP senators reversed their positions. Republican Senators Josh Hawley of Missouri and Todd Young of Indiana withdrew their support under pressure from the White House, resulting in a 50-50 tie. Vice President J.D. Vance cast a tie-breaking vote, blocking the measure.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 50, the Senate being equally divided. The Vice President votes... affirmative, and the point of order is sustained. Gotta make sure.
A yes vote would have limited President Donald Trump's authority to carry out further military action against Venezuela. Trump personally lobbied several Republican senators who had joined Democrats to advance the resolution the previous week and succeeded in preventing its passage. Senator Hawley, who had initially supported the resolution and voted with Democrats, said a conversation with Secretary of State Marco Rubio changed his stance on the resolution.
Marco Rubio just sent a letter responsive to my requests and concerns that certifies, number one, that the United States has no ground troops currently in Venezuela or operating in Venezuela. Number two, that if the administration sought to put ground troops into Venezuela, they would abide by the War Powers Act and they would come to Congress for congressional authorization. The secretary also told me directly that the administration will not put ground troops into Venezuela. They do not seek to occupy Venezuela. But his commitment to abide by the War Powers notification procedures and also the Constitution is directly responsive to my concern.
According to Hawley, Rubio assured him that the administration has no plans to deploy ground troops to Venezuela and that constitutional requirements would be followed if future deployments were considered, despite multiple Trump administration officials signaling longer-term involvement. And President Trump himself suggested that U.S. engagement in Venezuela would last for years. For more analysis, KPFA's Lawrence Schmidt spoke with Jared Huffman. The North Bay congressman weighed in on what would come next in Central America, Greenland, and here at home.
Congressman Huffman, the Senate vote on the War Powers Resolution related to Venezuela is largely symbolic, as President Trump has made it clear he would veto it, even as Republicans show signs of defecting. But something that I think is important to flag is that this resolution does not stop the United States from taking another country's resources, like Venezuelan oil and gas. Is there any leverage right now to prevent what critics call an imperial-style takeover?
Absolutely, and that's not an exaggeration. I mean, this, I don't think in the heyday of our most imperialistic, big dick diplomacy years, a century or more ago, that we ever just so nakedly said we're going to go in and grab their wealth, and we're doing it because we can. This is just unthinkable. And so I think there's a lot of bipartisan outrage in the Congress about this. Is there the will on the side of the Republicans to stand up? I don't know. That's been in very short supply.
Trump's operation into Venezuela was framed as regime change, but Trump announced today that he had a, quote, great conversation with the acting president, Delcy Rodriguez, who was actually Maduro's second in command. What does it say about the real goals of this so-called intervention, especially as we've initiated a $500 million oil deal with proceeds headed to the Qatari bank? And what are the implications globally?
Oh my gosh. I mean, there's so much corruption and impunity. The implications are vast. And, you know, the problem is we just get such different stories. I mean, I saw Trump and Rubio stand right next to each other and say different things about what the whole operation was about. With, you know, there was a claim of regime change, and then there was a claim of not regime change. And, you know, there's an incoherence to all of this. You know, our director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, kind of made her name by opposing regime change. And what's been interesting in all the briefings, including the classified one I had a few days ago, she's not even allowed to participate. So I think Trump has just surrounded himself with people who don't even really need a rationale. They just need to know that Donald Trump said to do this, and so we're going to do this. And his justifications for it have shifted several times. But I think you're right to focus on just the money and the power of it. I suspect at the end of the day, that's what it's about.
While senators were on the floor discussing the War Powers Resolution, there was also bipartisan concern voiced regarding Greenland. And representatives are saying Congress has the power to stop President Trump from invading. But I guess we're wondering how, if that was not the case in Venezuela.
Yeah, well, Greenland is a little bit different because Greenland is a territory of Denmark, which is a NATO member. And if you invade them, you blow up the whole North Atlantic Treaty alliance. So he's got to be more careful about that. But it's insane that he's even talking about it. So I was questioning a State Department witness in the Natural Resources Committee about this today, because if they choose one of the mechanisms that they may choose to try to strong arm Greenland is what they call a compact of freely associated states. We have this with Micronesia and Palau and a few other countries. But those were willing participants. Trump and others have mentioned, you know, having similar compacts where Greenland becomes functionally a territory of the United States. And so I grilled a witness about that today, and he said that there's been no discussion of that. But I think Congress has to step up and start speaking out about this. You can't just assume it's so crazy that he won't do it.
We're living in a moment where satire feels uncomfortably close to reality. I believe there was a recent Onion article joking that releasing only a tiny fraction of the Epstein files could be followed by a war to distract the public. And here we are, only 1% of those files have actually been released, and the conversation has largely disappeared from public view. Given that, do you believe Attorney General Pam Bondi should be held accountable? And why do you think the government continues to withhold this information from the public?
I'll be very candid. I think Pam Bondi is covering up for Donald Trump and probably for some other very powerful folks. I mean, what was it? He was quoted as saying that he has powerful friends that would be implicated and embarrassed if this all came out. So that's what it's all about. It is a cover-up. It's a naked cover-up. Yeah, sure, let's hold Pam Bondi accountable, but let's not pretend that this doesn't go all the way to the top. This is Donald Trump.
I want to pivot to the ACA subsidies, which are back in the news, and so is the possibility of another government shutdown. Can you update?
Yeah, so you know, last Friday, something very significant happened after you know, all of this fighting, 17 Republicans joined all the Democrats to vote out a clean three-year extension of those ACA premium tax credits. And this is something that we sort of staked out as the hill we were going to die on. We endured the longest government shutdown in history over this exact fight. And, you know, a lot of people said that, you know, you're never going to create enough leverage to bring Republicans your way. But Friday, we brought 17 of them our way. And that bill now goes to the Senate, which I think has hugely increased the negotiating leverage that senators have. So I think all eyes are on the Senate right now, but we're in a much better position today than we were, you know, a month or two ago.
Shifting briefly to energy policy, the administration is rolling back environmental protections under what critics are calling oil-friendly and fast-tracking their agenda. How does this impact the North Coast specifically? And it's my understanding you'll be in Humboldt County on the 18th.
Yeah, this is about offshore drilling. And, you know, it's one of these things we've been talking for years about the importance of, even though we don't have West Coast drilling in the lease plan for the Outer Continental Shelf, and it hasn't been in the lease plan for a couple of decades, we know what Californians think about this. We passed a moratorium on offshore drilling for the state waters that has been on the books for a couple of decades. And then we always assumed that nobody at the federal level would be stupid enough to try to do this. Well, welcome to, you know, Trump 2.0. They rolled out a new lease plan that calls for opening up the entire West Coast, pretty much all parts of Alaska, and the eastern Gulf of Mexico, which puts the Gulf side of the state of Florida and all of their beaches and coastal communities in harm's way as well. They left out the Atlantic side, of course, because there's an awful lot, you know, there's Mar-a-Lago over there, and there's a lot of other Republican opposition to drilling. But everywhere else is on the table now. And, you know, it's going to be very hard for anyone to actually drill in Humboldt County or any other part of the California coast. But I think in the past, we always assumed that, you know, between the State Coastal Commission and the State Lands Commission and the fact that they would need pipelines and infrastructure to bring this oil on shore, that we'd be able to stop them at the state and local level. These days with this group, I don't assume that. I mean, they could be so determined to do this that they bring tankers right into these platforms in federal waters and they bypass state onshore infrastructure entirely. So we've got to take this very seriously. And that's what we're going to be talking about at the briefing and the rally that we have.
And finally, Congressman Huffman, today marks 2 weeks into 2026, which begs the question, what can we expect over the next 50?
I think things are changing. I really think the tide is turning against Donald Trump. I will tell you that my Republican colleagues, especially those in tough districts, they feel like they've already lost. I mean, they are hanging their heads. They feel totally despondent about how unpopular they are and he is, and their one big ugly bill, nobody likes it and they know it. So that all is, you know, I think working in the direction of major change, but along with that comes a desperation. And I think that's why you see the escalation of this paramilitary activity by ICE in the streets in Minneapolis, and it's coming to other cities. So we really have to stand with our neighbors and be united and be smart and definitely stand up to this, but do it in a smart and strategic and peaceful way. That's what I see coming. I see this thing coming toward a Democratic wave election that will be met with huge desperation by Donald Trump, who will try to prevent us from having that election and from winning it.
Thank you again for speaking with KPFA News.
Thanks, Lauren.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A South Dakota tribal leader discussed working with the state government on healthcare and law enforcement during a speech Wednesday, as South Dakota Searchlight's Megan O'Brien reports.
Rosebud Sioux Tribe President Kathleen Woodenknife delivered the annual State of the Tribes address to lawmakers. She backed two pieces of legislation that impact tribal nations. She wants support to move toward a tribal managed care model. That would pool Medicaid funding and allow tribes to negotiate costs for off-reservation care. She also says support for managed care is essential for tribal members.
Imagine that when a patient is looking for an appointment, the managed care call center helps find the best appointment with the least waiting time.
Will Mortensen is a Republican representative from Fort Pierre and a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. He's sponsoring a bill to help with the effort.
I think this is among the most groundbreaking proposals that will come before the legislature this year.
Wooden Knife also supports a bill that would add tribal police to the state's legal definition of a certified law enforcement officer. That would add protections, like making it easier to prosecute people who assault tribal officers on non-tribal land. Puri Poirier is a Republican representative from Rapid City and a member of the Oglala Sioux Tribe. She's on a state committee studying the overrepresentation of Native American children in foster care. There's no legislation on that this year, but she says committee members are making progress.
Because they're getting in the room, they're having the conversations that they need to have, and they're coming up with mutual beneficial solutions.
There are 9 tribal nations in South Dakota. Nearly 10% of people in the state identify as Native American.
That was Megan O'Brien reporting. Alaska has one of the highest rates of fatal drug overdoses in the country, but addiction treatment services in Southeast Alaska are limited. As KRBD's Hunter Morrison reports, the Ketchikan Indian community is looking to change that by opening the state's first tribally-led addiction healing center.
About 15 miles north of downtown Ketchikan, Second Waterfall gushes into a rocky shoreline. The natural wonder can be seen and heard from inside the clubhouse of the former Salmon Falls Resort, a longtime tourist destination for fishing, dining, and lodging. A long and blue staircase out the door leads directly to the large fall.
Quite the waterfall.
The 11-acre facility has gone through many hands over the years and was foreclosed on in November. The Ketchikan Indian community purchased the property in cash 2 days after finding out it was up for grabs.
It met all of the qualifications we needed to be able to really move forward on a wellness center.
That's KIC President Gloria Burns. She says the new facility will blend Western and traditional healing practices that will focus on an individual's needs.
For some people, they are going to say that my disassociation from not speaking my language is so profound that I can't get by it, and that is my path to healing. And some will say to us, I dream of fish every day in the morning, Gloria. I need to be on the water. I need to be providing for my family.
A 2020 study from a Ketchikan nonprofit found that addiction treatment is one of the most pressing health needs in the area. But the island has just 2 addiction treatment facilities. And Southeast Alaska's only detox center in Juneau closed about a year ago. Unlike some tribally run healing centers, which are only open to tribal members or Native people, KIC's new facility will be open to everyone. The tribe is still fleshing out a plan for what the healing center will look like and how it will operate. But Burns hopes it'll be open next fall. I'm Hunter Morrison.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Suzanne Potter, Lauren Schmidt, and Antonio Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcast and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.